Dr. Lydia Black, who has just retired from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. My name is Rose Speranza, and we're at Ron Inouye's house. Ron Inouye is also present. Okay, Lydia, we had talked about starting out with a few basics about your life. What was your early childhood?
Well, first of all, I'm an immigrant. So was my husband. We are from Russia. I am from the south, from the city of Kiev. My husband was from St. Petersburg. And we met after the end of the Second World War in the city of Munich in Germany, where the refugees from Russia, Yugoslavia, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, whoever was fleeing from the communist onslaught, organized a refugee university. We had the creme de la creme of European scholars, Eastern European scholars, and German scholars who studied in Russia before the revolution or in Prague, teaching at this institution. The sponsoring institution was UNNRA, United Nations something something Relief and Repatriation. The Western powers, especially Americans, labored under the impression that the only reason people move is for economic reasons. They could not understand that there were millions fleeing for ideological and personal safety reasons. And no amount of an economics were far from our thoughts. We needed to survive, but we were not after riches. We didn't think America's streets were paved with gold. The university, and so a lot of young people whose education was interrupted by World War II came to Munich for this international refugee university. But we were closed down by the little flower, Ferrella LaGuardia. We were all called to a meeting, and Fiorella addressed us and said, we are cutting off all support to the university, and we are taking away your ration cards, because then you're going to go home, because nobody was going to go home. And as he was speaking, the men especially began edging closer to the doors and windows and making a rapid exit, because that was the time, which you probably neither you or Ron remember, when there was forced repatriation of citizens of countries under the Soviet regimes. They were under bayonet and gun. They were put on trains and sent back home, and they never saw home, of course. And there was great resistance. There were many bloody encounters. Many people died in this forced repatriation. And especially hard it was on the former prisoners of war from the Soviet armies, because Stalin has declared, "I have no prisoners of war, only traitors." And every prisoner of war who was returned was treated that way. So that's why the men began trying to seek the nearest exit from the hall where Ferrella LaGuardia was telling us how we were going to go home. And after that, so I got an equivalent of, I don't know, maybe equivalent of junior standing in the United States in a college, because I had physics and higher mathematics and various other things. Well, the university was very strong on sciences. But my husband had the chance to go to Munich Institute of Technology, which is German MIT. And so I went to work. Mm-hmm. And he got here, and we were, he was all done with his degree, and he was assured a job in Germany, and we liked it. We got along well with people. Let bygones be bygones. Germany, Western Germany, was very pressed because there were millions and millions of refugees, and many, many refugees who were German from Eastern Germany. And I get very cynical when I hear all this, quote, ethnic cleansing, end quote, because I have witnessed ethnic cleansing when areas of Germany that were delivered to Poland in compensation for eastern area that were given to the Soviet Union by the victors. The Germans had to leave, and they left in worse conditions than what I can judge is happening in Bosnia or in Albania or in Kosovo right now. They came just in clothes they stood up with, and children died, and nobody said boo. The same in Sudetenland, the part of Czechoslovakia was which ethnically German. All those people, they were flooding. And then, of course, refugees from the Eastern Germany that was partitioned after the war into four zones, the French, American, English, and Russian. And people from the Russian zones were fleeing to Germany. Western Germany was just a rump and in ruins. They were flattened by Allied bombing. And so every non-German citizen had to register for immigration. And it was very funny because the scuttlebutt was that it is very hard to get into the United States. And since my husband was assured a job in Germany, and he was almost done with his advanced degree at the best German technical school, we registered for immigration to the United States. We got our visas in 6 months, to everybody's surprise. Well, we asked for postponement, and we were told by the American representative that if we don't take up our visa, we will be barred from entering the United States. And we kind of contemplated what to do. But I worked for the UNRWA and then IRO, International Refugee Organization, Child Care Agency. I was in charge of the documentation center, documentation department of the Center for Homeless Children who were non-German, children who were without parents or relatives and so on. And also they were children of women from Eastern Europe who were displaced persons who had children racially mixed. They could not immigrate with racially mixed children. They were forced to give them up. And we took them in. And I was in charge of documenting because, for example, there was one child in that center. She was found after an Allied bombing, I don't remember in which city, in a rubble. And all she had on her chest was a placard with the name Natasha. And we had to create legal personalities for children like that. And we were very successful. I keep up with one of my British colleagues to this day. Some of the children, we were able to reunite with their families, found their relatives and so on. So I had an interesting job too. And one of the people who worked there was Marie Milan from Switzerland. And she told us, don't refuse the chance to go to the United States, because we were given 2 weeks to pack up and move. And She said, in Switzerland, the men have been put on the alert, and we were told to replenish our emergency supplies at home. And so that means there is some kind of crisis coming on. And my husband listened to Marie, and he said, well, by tank from Berlin to Munich, it's maximum 36 hours. Let's go. And we went through Bremerhaven on an old troop transport ship, chock full of refugees. And since I spoke English, I was impressed into service as an interpreter for the commander of the Marine Detachment, who was in charge of keeping order among the refugees. It was a beautiful crossing. We arrived in New York. The immigration service was very nice. We met our sponsors. We didn't understand how it worked through the church organization of some sort. It's.
You mean one that's still going?
Now? Oh yeah, yeah. I can't remember
is
the
that
official.
One that brings in a lot of people from South America and Central America.
I don't know. But they were very nice people, very conservative, fundamental Presbyterians from southern New Jersey. They were meeting us, and we were not coming, and they were getting very hyper because I was interpreting for the immigration service. But once that was done, we were rushed through customs. I turned to an immigration agent, and I said, don't we get any kind of identification card or he said, oh no, madam, you are in the United States now. You don't need that sort of thing. And today I often think how things have changed. Yeah. He said, well, in January, in the first 2 weeks, you just go to the post office and send us a postcard with your current address. That's all that is required. Nice. We felt so free. And we got.
About what year was that?
Oh, that was.
I may have missed it. In
1950. And under Displaced Persons Act, Immigration Act. And we were brought up, even though we came from middle class intellectual families. My husband's people were engineers and scientists and artists on my side of the family, and my mother's before the revolution scientists and military men, and my father's side lawyers and physicians. And but we were brought up that no work is demeaning. So my husband took a job at the gas station pumping gas until we found our feet and oriented ourselves. My English was pretty good. My math was pretty good. I was hired as a bookkeeper in a small business. And a friend of ours, who also a United States physician, she was one of the first women to get an MD in the United States. She's dead now. She worked at the same organization as I did in the children's center. And she recommended my husband for a job, a technical job, and at Flint, Michigan, where she was working at that time. So we moved there. And my husband decided that he needed to finish his degree. And he tried. We didn't understand American educational establishment or the hierarchy. So he tried to, small schools. And they all turned down on ABD from the best engineering school in Germany. So then he said, well, I'll write an MIT. And MIT offered him a research assistantship. By that time, we had our eldest girl, Anya. And we moved to Boston, where my husband did some very interesting work, even as a graduate student. He got his degree, and we moved to Texas, but he was a northerner. He couldn't live without birches, so we went back to New England, and he worked for Arthur D. Little, which is the biggest and greatest in scientific consulting firm in the United States. He participated. He had many patents developed, which in his name, but commercial exploitation went to United States government because it was mostly done on United States government contract. For example, the infrared heaters that the polar flyers use, that's my husband's patent. And the layer insulation, the aluminum that you make space blankets.
Yeah, that I knew you had mentioned that before.
That is my husband's patent. And posthumously, I got a certificate from a grateful nation, but it would be very nice if they helped with the college tuition for our children. I was perfectly happy to be at home, a proverbial housewife. I like to cook and I love to garden. I learned to garden at my grandmother's knee, and it's my joy. But I also continued with my scholarship, because from the background I come from, scholarship is not associated with school or degree or anything of that sort. My maternal grandmother received a advanced graduate degree from University of Warsaw in mathematics in the 19th century. But she ended up taking care of six children, four of her own and two of her sisters. And she was a very good wife to my grandfather. We just didn't see those roles as antithetical. You could be a housewife and you could be a scholar. You could be a gifted mathematician. But the children were growing up. College was, and I didn't have a piece of paper that said I finished kindergarten. And things were beginning to change, and you needed a paper for anything. Northeastern University in Boston in the 60s developed a program for women whose education was interrupted by World War II. Women who left college and went to work while their husbands and fiancés and went to war. I joined that program, and in short order, I was very fortunate. Northeastern, the dean was very understanding, and he gave me credit for I don't know what, all the work I have done at the Honor University in Munich, and my scholarship, and I showed him some of my writing and whatnot. So I was advanced very fast, and I got a Bachelor of Science degree in history from Northeastern University with highest honors. They are a proletarian school. They do not believe in Latin. By then I found that my husband died that same spring, and I found out that I could not continue in any academic endeavor without an advanced degree. And I had four children, so I thought, well, no job is too demeaning. I can be a teller in a bank or checkout person in a grocery store. And my two older daughters, 17 and 16 years old, they confronted me and said, "Mother, don't be crazy. You do this, you will be zone happy. The entire family is going to fall apart. Go and get your advanced degree and we'll help." And I didn't know what to do with my advanced degree, because my early training was in philology. And when I talked to the dean at Northeastern, and I that my field was philology, he said, there is no such animal in the United States. And he thought, I think the nearest thing is anthropology. Well, yes, and one of my professors, an anthropologist at Northeastern, Dr. Horner, his daughter graduated not too long ago from Berkeley with a PhD in anthropology, and I was at her graduation party. He suggested, he was an Africanist and the chairman of the department at Brandeis. Dr. Manners was also an Africanist, so he got me into Brandeis. But it was not a very congenial atmosphere, because in those days, women in their 40s didn't go to school. And especially they didn't talk back to very young professors.
This was in the 70s, mid-70s?
That was in 69.
69.
Yeah. And I decided that I was going to quit, that this was American academia was not for me. But I have given a paper at the Northeastern Anthropological Association meeting on Gila kinship, in which I pointed out the errors of Levi Strauss and his interpretation of data. And Floyd Lounsbury of Yale asked me for a copy of the paper. And I sent it to him, and he said, this is the best piece of scholarship I have read in the last 20 years. Don't quit. And I also met at that meeting Dr. Nancy Munn. She did her fieldwork in Australia, and later on she switched to New Guinea. She has written a very influential book, Walbiri Iconography, and many others. And I was introduced to her by a person, a researcher attached to Brandeis, who was independently wealthy. He didn't have to go along with faculty who thought I was very unusual and disruptive in the department. So he introduced me to Nancy Munn, and she invited me to come and finish my PhD at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And I did. I went down there in 71, and I had my PhD in hand by June 73.
That's very bad.
I had four children to support. I couldn't dawdle. And I had very supportive faculty. As a matter of fact, the chairman of my dissertation committee at the moment is staying at my apartment.
Oh, is that what?
Yes.
Alfred
B. Bacon Hudson, the son of Elizabeth Bacon and Alfred Hudson, who were the former scholars in the United States anthropology on Central Asia. Alfred Hudson Sr. did other work in Asia, but Elizabeth Bacon is, of course, her book on Central Asia under the Soviet rule is still in print.
Yeah. I'll have to look it up. I'm ashamed to say I don't know it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I made lifelong friends, especially among the faculty, because once again, it was 71, 72, 73. The graduate students were pitifully young. And even professors were young. And I was much closer in age to faculty than to the students. And they were awfully supportive. And as I say, I made lifelong friendships.
What was your topic?
My topic was an analysis, structural analysis of the symbolic system to uncover the underlying principles of the belief and ritual system of the people of Sakhalin known as NIF. Yeah, and my dissertation is pretty widely known internationally.
That's the one on the whale and the bear.
It's,
the whale and the dog.
Right? No. Dogs, bears, and killer whales.
Yeah, I was close. I've actually read it. We have a copy of it at the library.
Yeah. Well, Dominique tells me that I was quoted by Levi Strauss in his most recent book, so I have arrived.
Congratulations.
And again, there was this situation. I had my degree in hand. I was looking for a job, and I was offered a job at Providence College in Rhode Island. And I knew several people, especially at Brandeis, who would say, we will reject any job unless it is a well-known major university or Ivy League. And I went to, because this, going to a small university will kill our careers. I went to the chairman of my department. He's now retired, Dr. Richard Woodbury. He is a famous archaeologist of Southwest in the United States. He is a holder of Kidder Award in American archaeology. And he said, Lydia, academic jobs are going scarce and scarcer. Take it. And I taught in Providence College, and we had a very nice program. It was very rigorous. I taught a variety of subjects. It was undergraduate, but several of our fledglings are now teachers. As a matter of fact, Robin Mills and Marianne Sweeney were knew one of our students when he was finishing his PhD and was a teaching assistant at Boston University. And my favorite student, Mike Nassani, is now professor of archaeology at Western Michigan State and very well regarded, widely published. And I had something to do with it because he was a son of Lebanese immigrants, and he asked me to come to dinner at his house and talk to his parents because they didn't want him to go to graduate school. And his father said, I don't want my son to fail. I said, give him a chance. Let him at least know that he tried to reach, you don't have to succeed, which is, if he wants it, let him try. Well, and he turned to Mike and said, son, is this what you want? And Mike said, yes. He said, all right, I'll support you. Now we have Professor Nassani. So, it was a very conservative Dominican college, and anthropology was viewed kind of a subversive discipline, and they decided to limit the program, that it would be just kind of an elective. But I was not looking for a job. I was on tenure. I was due for a promotion to full professor. And I was on 2 years leave on a grant of from National Endowment for the Humanities Translation Program to do the manuscript journal of Father Yakov Nitsvetov, an Orthodox priest in Alaska who was of Aleut origin and who introduced Orthodoxy to the Yupik of Yukon and Kuskokwim area and to the Athabascans of that upper Yukon in Oka and middle Yukon. And one nice day there was a phone call and there was Dr. Powers on the line and asked me if I would like to come up for a semester. So I applied for extension of one semester leave I came here for one semester.
That was 1983?
Yes, and that is when Rose, you first were in my classes.
Right. Right, back in the old days when they had more classes and they were mixed classes. The first one I had with you had freshmen from the villages and seniors going on. That was American Indians.
Yeah. And by the end of the semester, the chancellor invited me to come to the university with tenure as a full professor. And since my youngest daughter went to college, I thought, well, I'm a liberated mother. So I arrived here with one suitcase, two cats, and one kayak.
Do you want to take a break before we talk about your academic career?
Yeah. Well, I think perhaps, you know, this is how I came to be in Alaska. But the reason I was asked to come to Alaska, Rose, was because I was required in Providence College to teach the Circumpolar Culture Area. Our majors, they had to have grounding in linguistics and language and culture, in archaeology, in physical anthropology, at least four theoretical courses, and they had to have at least two culture area, knowledge of two culture area. It was a very rigorous program. And I was teaching Circumpolar. And when I came to the Aleuts, I found there was nothing written that you could give the students on the Aleuts. And I began composing lectures, and then down on me, I was doing basic research. I applied for an NIH grant to go to the Aleutians. I got it. I hit it off, and I stuck. And this is why I was asked to come here, because by the time they asked me in the 80s, I spent about 10 years working with the Aleutian people. Okay.
Okay, it's recording if you want to just continue the way you were about the cultural benefit.
Well, my interests are mostly theoretical, and I enjoyed the theoretical work that I have done. But in terms of my role in Alaska, and not at the university, but in Alaska, it has to do with my relationship with the Aleut people. And those people have suffered perhaps most in comparison to other native groups, because not only were they conquered by the Russians in the 18th century, and once they adjusted and they were part of the Russian establishment, many of them were well educated, they were middle class Aleuts. In the American period, they were degraded and became wards of the state and whatnot, and they didn't get their citizenship as was stipulated by the Alaska Treaty. And then, of course, during World War II, I don't need to tell you the story, you all know it, about the wartime relocation. They were very suspicious of people who came nosing around as scholars. Even though I arrived in Alaska under the escort of an Aleut priest and the Bishop of Alaska, Bishop Gregory then, they eyed me with suspicion. What happened was, because I had my then 8-year-old daughter with me, we went to church, and I didn't give it a second thought, but my daughter took her place on the left with the Aleut girls. When the time came to go to the communion, she went with the Aleut girls with proper ritual gestures, properly approached the chalice. And by the time we were coming out, everybody was all over us and hugging and kissing and saying, "Isn't it wonderful?" And I said, "But I told you I was Orthodox." Said, "Oh, many people say they're Orthodox because they want in, and it's only pretend." But they watched the child.
the child's behavior in the church. It was proper traditional behavior. That was it. That was my passport. And immediately, I began to be asked questions. I never formulated a problem and tried to collect data to answer my hypothesis. That's not my way. I wanted to get acquainted with the people to see how they live, what was the then contemporary situation. But they began setting tasks for me. And when I returned the next summer, the late Philemon Tutyakov said to me, the Japanese who were interned during the war have started an action for restitution. The same thing happened to us, but when we raised the question, we are told that this did not happen. There are no documents. Can you find the documents? I said, I'll try. And I went to Seattle to the National Archives, and I located the documentation. I also found out the documentation about the captivity of the Atuans and the return of the Atuans to the United States. The records were sold to Fish Market in Seattle as waste paper. But I found enough documentation, and I ordered microfilms done, and I bought copies of the microfilms. And I informed the person who asked me to do this. And then the head of the Aleutian People of Islands Association, Pat Pletnikov, he began, a younger man, he began a real push. Incidentally, his wife and sons live here in Fairbanks. He began a real push to collect documentation. He started interviewing survivors. And he got enough information to contact a law firm in Washington. One of the lawyers was John Kirtland, and I had a letter from John Kirtland that Pat Pletnikov told him that I had some documentation. Could he come up to Providence and consult with me? Well, I put some of the microfilms of the Pribilof logs on my microfilm machine in my living room. He read some of it. He was an ex-Navy officer. At one point, he started crying, and he said, my firm will take the case. And that was the beginning. And I think perhaps of all that I have accomplished, perhaps that was most important, because it changed tremendously what was happening in the Aleutian Islands today. And in sorting out the papers in my office, I came across the first letter from John Kirtland's inquiry, and then a letter of thanking me for telling him where the documents were, and for my hospitality, and so on and so forth. And I'm giving it to those letters to Allied Foundation.
What year was that lawsuit? I mean, that was pretty
big. It took about 10 years. John Kirtland deserves all the praise, amassing those, 12 volumes of documentation, and getting it through, and getting it before the Senate Commission on Wartime Relocation and Repatriation of Civilians, which in the preface acknowledges me and the help I have given the commission. But then the Alliots found a second task for me. And that really set me up, because they said, look, we're sick and tired of having all those beautiful books about Eskimo art. My father was an ivory carver, and his work was very different. But we have nothing to show our children. Can you please give us a record? And on very limited funds, I think about $1,500 from the Aleutian People of Islands Association, and from my own pocket additional funds, I traveled to the European museums, to the museums in the United States. I met with the late Ted Bank in Western Michigan. And I amassed enormous photographic collection of Aleut artifacts. And I wrote the book Aleut Art, which was published by Aleuts themselves, Aleutian Primitive Violence Association. They hold the copyright. I think that there is hardly an Aleut household in the state that doesn't have the book. It has been out of print for 10, 12 years.
Mm-hmm. How come it's never gone back into print? Just because everybody now has their copy?
Well, maybe there will be a second edition, because I have been telling Dmitry Filimonov, all it takes, give me one sentence that Aleutian Primitive Violence Association authorizes me to put out a second edition. And Dmitry, being Dmitry, he forgets. He loves me dearly, but he is too busy to remember to write it. And now that Alison Young is there, she will type it up and he'll sign it.
Oh, okay.
So maybe there will be a second edition.
Okay, well, that looks like it's pretty close to the end of side one, so to flip it off. This is the start of side two, and Lydia will just take up wherever she chooses.
Well, my relationship with the Aleut people continues. I'm quite sure that there are some people who dislike me or whatever. Nobody can be liked by everybody, but by and large I have a very close relationship with the Aleut communities from Atka to Sandpoint and King Cove, and I continue to do work. For example, when the Aleuts tried through Senator Stevens to get a right of visa-free travel to Commander Islands and have the Commander Islanders come here, because they are cousins and relatives, and in Russia the same as the Siberian Yupik of St. Lawrence have a right of visa-free travel. The State Department requested documentation that indeed the Commander Islanders and the Aleuts of the Aleutian Islands have kinship ties and they are single people. Well, I provided that. It has never been published. It just went into the legal documentation somewhere. Then in question of subsistence, there is this popular, politically correct propaganda-like stance that the Aleuts were slaves. The Aleuts know that this is a lie, but some of them use it as a political playing card. But they fully know that they never were slaves. And so when the subsistence debate started, especially about the fishing rights, I was asked to provide the synopsis of the rights that the Aleuts had under the Russian regime, specifically related to subsistence, which is encoded in the second and third charter of Russian American Company, which guarantees them inviolate right to their hunting and fishing territory grounds. Nobody could settle there without the indigenous community's consent and acceptance. They also anything that they take from the land or make is their or buy is their inalienable property, and that they can sell and trade whatever the produce for cash or in barter at their free will, except that the sea otter skins would be sold to the company. And again, this is somewhere in the Aleut Corporation's legal files. So I continue to do this kind of work. I have also, because so much of, especially in Southwest, Southeast, and South Central Alaska, so much of the native life is tied up with the Russian regime, my knowledge of Russian sources is very important. And I was expert witness in the sea otter case when the Fish and Wildlife agencies claimed that no artifacts can be made out of sea otter skins for sale. I don't know where the idea came from, but their position was that they presented to the court that the natives of Alaska did not use sea otters in any shape, form, or manner before the Russians came or before the British and American sea otter traders came. And I was able to document that indeed they used the sea otter, that among the Aleuts, women wore sea otter parkas. And when the Russians began trading knives and various other goodies to the men for sea otters, they stripped their women naked and traded the women's parkas. That they also traded sea otter blankets. And the crowning piece of my testimony was a document in the Navy archives, a letter from Catherine the Great to the governor of Siberia, Admiral Chichirin, thanking him for two beautiful sea otter rugs done from Kodiak Island, done in a mosaic fashion. And they were very beautiful and very curious, so that she gave one immediately to the Kunstkamera, which is the big ethnological museum. When I found the document, I went to the director of American section at Kunstkamera in 1995, Galina Zinyskevich, and said, and she immediately got the curator of artifacts to search the coffers for that sea otter rug, because given to Kunstkamera, brought by Stepan Glotta from Kodiak in 1766. So, I don't know, but the case was won. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I gave the records of that case to the archives, and I was involved in several other litigation situations. One of them, the National Park Service, there was a native claim in the Katmai National Park on the Brooks Lodge. The National Park Service asked me to see if the ancestress and on whose residence there the claim was based really existed, and I was able again through the Russian records find documentation that the judge accepted without any quarrel, and the claim was won. And the National Park Service has forgiven me for that. I think Kathy Arndt redeemed me because they think she walks on water.
Well, I was going to say, I don't know, but I was going to say your influence with the Aleuts and stuff is going to continue with all the people that you've trained. I mean, haven't you pretty much provided the next generation of scholars to work in the area of Russian Alaska, not Russian America, but Russian?
Well, I was, when I first came here, because the courses were new, they aroused some interest among the student body, and I thought they were worthwhile and pretty well, but as time went on, there seemed to be less and less interest, especially among the anthropology graduate students in the Russian period, the ones that have realized the importance of the Russian period and the relevance of what happened then to the, what is going on today, are very few. And of course, working in that field requires learning the language, and we have a stance that foreign languages are not necessary. And so there is very little interest among the student body in the Russian period today, which saddens me a great deal, because among the Yupik, among several Athabaskan groups, among a large proportion of the Tlingits, the Russian heritage is very important, especially through the Orthodox Church. And so it's kind of by default, again, because I worked with the journals of Father Yakov Nitsvetov, who is now Saint Jacob Enlightener of Alaska Native Peoples. I kind of been elevated to the status of the expert of Orthodoxy in Alaska. Against my will, it's kind of carried me, and I really think I sometimes think that there is a direction in a person's life. And I cannot forget that when Professor Powers called me to ask me to come to Alaska for a semester, and I next Sunday just I went to church with Zoya, and the priest says, well, on Tuesday, it was the day of St. Herman of Alaska, and since we had no service, we were going to have a little Te Deum here for St. Herman of Alaska. I said, I got the call on Tuesday. So maybe I was meant to come and become an expert in Orthodox Church in Alaska. I don't know. Well, I don't know what else I can tell you. But all I can say is that when I first came to Alaska, just in the early 70s, when Angsa has not yet taken roots, in the Aleutian Islands, it was a cultural desert. There was no awareness of any worthwhile heritage. There was kind of total despair. And the difference I see today, and I have been talking to Karen Stickman a few days ago, and she said, I'm interested in the native viewpoint. And I said, Karen, stop to think, what are you talking about when you're talking about native viewpoint? Is it yours? Is it somebody else? Or is it the earlier generation? And I said, I know it's now fashionable to point out that they are some points in Angsa that need fixing. But I remember the days when there was nothing before Angsa. And I remember some of the people now long dead who practically have given their lives, all they had, to get some rights to the land. And those people should be honored, not vilified. As, again, for political correctness, this is going on. As in, you talk to the older people, and they'll have very different perspective. Angsa empowered, in my view, the native people of Alaska. And granted, it's not ideal. I know just that as much, but it gave them back some life. There is cultural revival going on. The fact that a Native Cultural Heritage Center is being created in Anchorage on the terms that the natives want. This couldn't have happened 30 years ago. No way. So I don't know. I don't know what the future holds, but I think that the current generation needs to remember the elders who fought for their rights against tremendous odds and won.
Well, the students coming up doing that work soon, I imagine. I mean, they can't keep, you know. There's a lot of kids coming through oral history that I see that are going back, you know, when they're going back, they're not going that far back. They're going back 20 or 30 years now. They're looking for interviews that have been done with the people that, you know, the generation that you're talking about. So maybe some of the ones that are not middle age now, but the 20.
I am very saddened that Tundra Times became defunct. I am saddened that Alaska Native Arts Institute has become defunct.
Yeah, something else the other day surprised me that it had disappeared. I'm trying to remember what it was.
But the Tundra Times was a very good newspaper. It was the native voice for the entire state, and I hope that it will be revived someday. But I also think that it is a changed situation, so the people don't see any need for it anymore. So, but it's difficult to realize, but it's a whole generation passed. I hope that things will get better. I hope that I'll live long enough to see native doctors, native lawyers serving their own people, that they will be well-trained native teachers and well-trained university professors. And I emphasize well-trained, well-educated, erudite people.
Well, some of them are in the process of going off to school now. I know several students that are going off to law school and things. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you will see it in the next 5 or 8 years.
Yes, one of my former students is now a lawyer. And she's active in the Native Affairs. Vicky. I can't remember her maiden name. She's married now.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of Kendall.
No. I had her in 84, 85. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's... there is Darlene Orr, who is a marvelous scholar.
The linguist from St. Lawrence, right. I kind of lost track of what's happened to her.
Yes. So... Well, that's about all.
Well, why don't you just say a couple sentences about what your plans are in retirement now, what you're going to be doing, and if you're going to continue working?
Well, my agreement with the St. Herman Theological Seminary is that I will live there and help them to make an inventory and sort out the archival holdings that have never been sorted, and I will be able to do it in my own time without great pressure. But I also have some research commitments. One is working with Marvin Falk on publishing translations and annotated charts and pictorial materials from Russian Navy expeditions of the 18th century, which is a massive project, will take a great deal. Then I'm supposed to do an article for a proposed catalog of an expedition that is planned by Anchorage Museum of History of Art with Barbara Sweetland Smith as curator on the Russian expeditions in the Pacific, particularly North Pacific. And she asked me to write about interaction between the Russian Imperial Navy and Russian Academy of Sciences and their in organizing scientific work in the North Pacific. And then, of course, my book on Russians in Alaska is coming out soon in University of Alaska Press, and I'm looking forward to working with the designer, Dixon Jones. If plans go as proposed, there will be very good illustrations, a lot of material in color, never published before. If the University of Alaska Press comes through, I'll be very happy. The galley proofs should be in my hands any minute.
Oh, well, good. You're going to be busy. It sounds like you've got work mapped out for the next 10 years. And of course, Kodiak is the crossroads of Alaska, so you'll be getting lots of people coming and seeking your advice and visiting and looking for a place to stay.
As long as I don't come apart at the seams and the stuffing is going to ooze out.
What are the good research topics for good grad students? What do you think should be pursued?
Russian language and non-Russian language.
Well, anybody who works in the Arctic, the two languages that are absolutely necessary is Russian and Danish. It doesn't hurt to understand Norwegian either.
Good, then I feel a little better. I'm trying to take up my Danish again.
Yes, because a lot of excellent literature is published in those languages. Research topics for graduate students. It depends on the student's interest, of course. But one of my current students is doing ethnohistorical study of Kalmykovsky Redoubt on the Kuskokwim River compares it with information in interpretations derived from archaeological excavations conducted by Oswald in the 60s. And he was able to establish the entire demographic picture of the development of that community and the demise of that community in the Gold Rush era. There is a lot of the abandonment and of communities and resettlement under. A lot is to be done in the study of epidemics. Mm-hmm. We all know about the smallpox of 1838, but they were a devastating epidemic in 1883 on which no research has been done. And that affected, again, the distribution of the population. The introduction of the canning industry and the restructuring of settlements is another area that is not fully explored. And the history of fox trapping as an economic enterprise. There is a work coming out called Aleutians East, sponsored by Aleutians East Borough. Four of my graduate students worked in it, and former student Sarah McGowan did a study on the fox trapping. But the fact that the fox trapping provided very good living to many natives engaged in it, to a point that pianos were imported from Seattle for children gifted in music so that they could study music at home. That has never been explored.
Actually, yeah, I can think of, as you're talking, 100 things that, you know, I kind of know that I've never seen anything of.
Yes, yeah. And it's time to rethink our definition of subsistence. I think we should go to the Russian model. Subsistence is not exhausted by what you eat, because in the modern world you need cash, and subsistence means it's a means of getting cash to get you the means to get the food and clothing and so on and so forth. So no, there's a lot to do, but. Is that all right, Ron?
Okay, well, thank you, Lydia. I appreciate that very much.
Okay.